Welcome to CotaCast, the podcast for debate discussion about all topics related to general and geriatric medicine. And this is the next CotaCast in our stroke series. And we have covered stroke assessment and diagnosis, imaging, and treatment of acute ischemic stroke. So this episode, we're going to focus more on what happens next, looking at blood pressure control, secondary prevention, and thinking about further investigation. So today we've got Johnny with us and Chris. So hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Happy New Year.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy New Year, everyone. So let's kick off then. And should we talk about our patients on the stroke ward? And I thought maybe the first thing we could talk about is what kind of potential medical complications we should be looking out for these patients, or what they're at risk of. Chris, what kind of things do you see in your day-to-day
work? I suppose the big one in people who've had reperfusion therapy, whether that be kind of thrombolysis or thrombectomy, is early neurological deterioration that might mean that there's something awry as a consequence of the intervention. And by that, we would either think of, in younger people with very big ischemic strokes, things like the malignant MCA syndrome, where people develop a decreased conscious level, worsening of their neurological signs that's associated with a large degree of edema within the brain, which is a response to ischemia. And obviously the brain's a closed box. And so that pressure, raised intracranial pressure, starts leading to various changes in conscious level, which is probably an early thing to look out for, particularly in younger patients, because obviously as people are older and they get cerebral atrophy, there's more space in the skull so that they can accommodate those things a little bit more. So neurological deterioration secondary to that is one thing. Neurological deterioration secondary to hemorrhage is probably the next thing, which is obviously if somebody has had clot-busting medication like thrombolysis and they then have a change in conscious level, they need to go back to the CT scanner to make sure that they've not bled. It's difficult to really know what you would actually do about that if they have bled, because the half-life of alteplase is so short that realistically, unless the infusion's still running, there's not really much of a role for reversal agents for thrombolysis if the infusion's already run through, realistically. And then the other thing is if people have been thrombolized for posterior circulation strokes, because the posterior fossa is smaller than the anterior fossa, you're at an increased risk of developing complications from things like cerebellar infarcts, which is usually things like obstructive hydrocephalus. So they're the big things that I would probably look out for in the sort of relatively acute phase. In terms of, obviously, you mentioned at the start about how we would manage blood pressure and things like that acutely in people that have had stroke, either that have been thrombolized or had thrombectomy or not been thrombolized, and the guidelines and what we do are slightly different. And usually, in order to be able to give people thrombolytic therapy, you can't have a systolic blood pressure of over 185 or a diastolic blood pressure of over 110. So if people have got a systolic or a diastolic blood pressure over those parameters, then they need blood pressure lowering therapy to bring that down to be able to give them thrombolysis in the first place. Yeah. And depending on where you work, we do different things in different parts of the country. So for us, generally, we would usually use labetalol boluses to try and get it down, but people often will need something like a GTN infusion to keep their blood pressure below 180 over 105 in the first 24 hours after thrombolysis. So that's the big thing, really, is if people are very hypertensive and they've had thrombolysis and it's that first 24 hours, they need blood pressure lowering therapy to keep the blood pressure below those targets.
But I guess, Chris, if you're a junior doctor on nights or what have you, and you've got someone whose blood pressure's staying high and the GTN infusion's going up, what would you recommend someone doing in those situations?
That's a good question. Realistically, if people are already on one intravenous agent for hypertension after immediate treatment for ischemic stroke, I'd probably be referring them to critical care for second line blood pressure management, because, you know, in simple terms, if you've loosened the fluid in the plumbing and the pressure in the plumbing is higher than it should be, then the risk of bleeding or leaking from the plumbing system is going to be higher. So if people's blood pressure is resistant to single line intravenous agent, then if they need a second agent, then they should be in a critical care setting. So that would be my recommendation for people like that.
Maybe that's not another cause, like urinary retention. Yeah.
Don't want to ring the ITU reg when it's just someone's got a full bladder.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, it's nothing that a bladder scan can't fix. But that's a very fair point. And the number of people that we see that, they come back from scan and they're sort of squirming around a bit, and you think, oh, well, should we just check that they're not actually, or they just need a pee, and then we can avoid having to give them labetalol and GTN, and they just need a wee, which is, which happens quite frequently. So yes, kind of easy reversible things like, do they need a wee, or do they need the toilet, or are they in pain, or do they feel sick? Particularly, I mean, we might talk about this a bit later, but hemorrhages or people that have had posterior strokes and they've got vertigo and they feel sick and they're vomiting, and that's also driving the blood pressure up. So simple things like, are they nauseous? Do they need an antiemetic? That can also help, the kind of the easy conservative things to kind of bring the blood pressure down. So they're kind of blood pressure and conscious level changes are the big ones that I would probably say in the immediate sort of first 24 hours are the important thing. And then generally we should be keeping people with acute stroke on a hyperacute stroke unit for the first 72 hours of their stay if it's required, because it's a higher level monitoring environment, and people have, the mortality rates have been shown to be significantly reduced with care on hyperacute stroke units compared to not on hyperacute stroke units. So it's really important that people that have had stroke get to the right place ASAP. And we have a national audit program called SNAP, which is designed to measure stroke performance really across the country. And one of the key metrics is that they arrive on a HASU after their stroke, after presentation, within 4 hours. And we're kind of measured and audited on that. So people need to be on a HASU as quickly as possible. It's a specialist area that's a bit akin to a coronary care unit for stroke, in that you'll have, our hyperacute unit in where I work has 11 beds. Every bed has its own bedside monitor, where people are, continuously attached to monitoring to look for arrhythmias, AF, obviously, as you mentioned, principally because of the risk of stroke with AF. But they have more invasive monitoring, regular blood pressures, skin monitoring. People are often on certain types of VTE prophylaxis, which we can come to.
I guess nursing staff who are used to looking out for neurological deteriorations and the kind of things that, you were just talking about before.
And simple things like swallow screens and noticing that somebody maybe coughed on something, which might mean that their swallow is not safe with the current consistency that they are eating, and therefore you can reduce your risk of aspiration and chest infections and those sorts of things. So it's a multidisciplinary thing, really. It's a site where you've got lots of people that are very used to looking after people that have had stroke, which is where you want to be in the acute phase, because it helps improve outcomes in the longer term and reduce mortality. So we want people on a stroke unit. We want them closely monitored. In terms of slightly later complications, I suppose it's, the effects of being less mobile than normal, and that comes down to VTE, skin damage, infection. Not everybody that has a chest infection after a stroke is aspirated. We could call it stroke-associated pneumonia, which a number of people, including myself, tend to use, because not all post-stroke pneumonias are aspiration. Some of them are just because of hypostasis and being sat in bed more than usual, not fundamentally because they're aspirating gastric contents or food's going down the wrong way.
I've not heard that term before.
I
Yeah,
hadn't
feel
heard of
free
it
to start
until I moved
using
to
it. It's a good one.
Newcastle.
Yeah, I'm gonna use that.
I mean, if somebody's overtly deteriorated in their swallow and has been coughing on their current consistencies, or has had a vomiting episode and has then become unwell, then it might well be aspiration. But actually, if we are assessing people's swallows as part of stroke and they're being fed, and we're doing that correctly, then they shouldn't really be developing aspiration pneumonias anyway. Obviously, if people are NG fed because their swallow is unsafe, an NG tube doesn't completely eradicate the risk of aspiration pneumonia. That is fair enough. So it's possible, but it's just maybe one to think about, that not all post-stroke pneumonias are aspiration.
And then you mentioned obviously complication for not being as mobile. I was going to ask you about this, about kind of VTE prophylaxis in stroke patients and what you have kind of what we've done in the past and what we're maybe doing now. It's a bit different, isn't it?
There was a series of trials that have been done over the years called the CLOTS trials, and there was CLOTS 1, CLOTS 2, and CLOTS 3 that basically looked at comparing eventually standard TED stockings that you would find on a kind of orthopedic or surgical ward, and something called IPC, which stands for intermittent pneumatic compression, which are inflatable thigh-length squeezy cuffs that get connected to the pump on the end of the bed, which intermittently inflate and deflate to try and stimulate or simulate kind of calf pressure and reduce VTE that way. And essentially, what they showed was that IPCs were far superior to TED stockings in terms of preventing DVT and PE and reducing mortality, but keeping more people alive that needed nursing care, which, is kind of an interesting paradox of, yes, we're keeping more people alive, but to need to be in 24-hour care because they survived with severe disability after their stroke. So, kind of ethically thinking about that, you think, well, is that a good outcome or not? I'm not quite sure. But essentially, the take-home message is we don't use TED stockings. We tend to use IPCs principally for the first 30 days after stroke, and that could be ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke. And then beyond 30 days, if they're still tolerated, we would continue using IPCs. But if they are not tolerated, then we'd have to have a think about why that was and what options might we have at that point, which would usually be something like low molecular weight heparin, tinzaparin, or enoxaparin is fine. In that initial 30-day period, the national guidelines would still not endorse using low molecular weight heparin because there's not enough trial data to support its use safely.
Well, I was going to ask about that. Just from having worked in different areas, and they had different kind of approaches to when they might start kind of tinzaparin or enoxaparin. So I was going to ask. So the
Yeah, and well, so Clots 4 is coming, which is to compare IPC and low molecular weight heparin, so it's sort of the next step. But that's I think is about to start or has just started. So we won't get any data from that for a few years. And I think there's a very distinct group of people who have had a stroke and are less mobile than normal and are therefore at risk of VTE, but won't tolerate IPC for various reasons. And that might be because they're contraindicated because they have a leg ulcer or they have really bad varicose veins or they have superficial skin breakdown or cellulitis, and therefore IPC is contraindicated because it might make that worse. Critical limb ischemia, peripheral arterial disease, those sorts of things it wouldn't be recommended for. So there are those people. And then there are also people who, as part of their stroke, maybe because they've got communication problems or because they've got delirium, won't tolerate IPCs because they want to try and get us out of bed. And obviously they're attached to a pump on the end of the bed, which is a falls risk and a risk of causing trauma and broken hips and all sorts of terrible outcomes. So there is a subgroup of people for whom what is the option? Because we theoretically should give IPC or nothing because of a worry about bleeding. But these people do have quite a significant risk of venous thromboembolism and are not covered. So there's a couple of devices. Actually, there's one device that is, it's called a Gecko device, which sits over the fibula head and stimulates the common peroneal nerve to create kind of foot contractions and stimulate kind of calf action and movement, which has been proven to be quite successful in the data that we've seen, and is licensed by NICE, but isn't explicitly in the latest stroke guidelines, I don't think. So that's something that's starting to kind of come through. And then anecdotally, we probably are using some low molecular weight heparin earlier than the guidelines would suggest we should do, partly because it seems to be safe anecdotally. And if you were going to give somebody a DOAC for their AF at 2 weeks post-stroke, prophylactic dose low molecular weight heparin, the bleeding risk profile is lower than that of anticoagulation. So why would you not do it if they're not tolerant of other things and their mobility is still reduced? And we also see neurosurgical patients with hemorrhages that arrive on day two with prophylactic tinzaparin. And I don't know what their evidence base is for doing that, but these people seem to do fine, but that's not what I'm endorsing we should do. But it just makes you think, well, we definitely have a certain cohort of patients that are at risk and end up being at risk and suffering VTE. So there probably has to be a bit of flexibility, but the kind of take home is IPC is the standard for acute stroke patients, and that's what you should be prescribing when people come to a stroke unit. You shouldn't be prescribing people low molecular weight heparin unless it's been stipulated by a consultant stroke physician, really. And don't give people TED stockings because they just cause pressure damage and don't prevent VTE, really, in stroke patients.
Okay, great. And I was going to ask you about post-stroke seizures, because often that might be something that junior doctors might get called to the ward to see, kind of after maybe infection and kind of DVT and stuff. And how much of that do you see, and do you tend to see in a certain subgroup of patients or certain types of stroke?
That's a good question. It's quite unpredictable, really. One thing that I would probably start with is there's one some of the exclusion criteria from the original stroke trials were about seizure at onset of stroke syndrome, and therefore some people think that if somebody's had a seizure, you couldn't possibly thrombolyze them, because it's just going to be a TODS phenomenon and it's all post-ictal. And I think it's always worth, if you are ever in that situation where somebody has that sort of thing, did they have symptoms before the seizure? Was there a sign that they may have had weakness, etc., before the seizure? It's very, very difficult. But that's just one thing I would say, is that seizures at onset does not necessarily mean that they're not having a stroke and you can't potentially give them treatment. So it's just worth thinking about in case they've had neurological symptoms before the seizure started. And obviously, that's not to say, well, it's part of a pre-seizure prodrome, et cetera, but if somebody looks like they've got a focal neurological deficit consistent with stroke, they've had a seizure, but it started before the seizure, I'd still strongly think that it might be stroke as the precipitant for it.
What you said before when we did the assessment podcast about making sure you kind of nail the history so that you're making informed decisions about the treatment, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I suppose we are maybe a little bit more fortunate now than years ago in that we've got the advent of new imaging techniques such as MRI or CTP, which can help us rule in or rule out things like stroke as part of that sort of presentation. But you can get MRI changes in seizure, and CTP is not always correct. So there are always caveats to these things, but we've got options and things that we could do. In terms of the people that I would tend to see that have seizures at onset or very early on, it's a bit difficult to predict, really. The people that I have seen recently with that are people that have got pre-existing metabolic or biochemical disturbances. So I've seen somebody recently that had quite advanced renal failure, obviously with kind of low serum bicarbonate and things like that, and who had seizures at onset, which, I kind of wondered whether that just their vulnerable metabolic state made them more likely to fit than somebody that didn't. But there's not necessarily, in my mind, a particular demographic that I would suggest are more prone to have, kind of early seizures. The way that I would manage them is as you would do for any kind of seizure. So obviously it's, if you're called as part of an arrest scenario, it's A, B, C, D, E, make sure their airway's patent, make sure they've got some high flow oxygen, they're in a position on the side and they're supported where able. And treat as you would do. So it would be, bolus of benzodiazepines, whether that's IV if you've got access or PR if not. And then if seizures persist, then it would be a case of loading them with anti-epileptic drugs initially. We tend to use Keppra quite frequently, sort of anywhere from 4 grams to 4.5 grams as a kind of loading dose based on weight. To just get them out of the initial seizure period. It doesn't, you would just treat it as you would anybody that's having seizures. The debate really then comes into at what point do you call seizure a provoked seizure of acute onset because of the stroke versus a post-stroke seizure? Partly because that has longer term implications about how you would manage them with anti-epileptic drugs and things about driving and those sorts of issues. So obviously anybody that's had a seizure can't drive for 6 months and they have to notify the DVLA. That's just the DVLA stipulation. But generally we would say that if people have had seizures within 2 weeks after the stroke, that would indicate it's probably an early stroke seizure. And yes, you might want to consider covering them with some anti-epileptics for a time period and then review in clinic with a view to weaning off, because the risk of recurrence is far lower than people that have seizures beyond that 2 week period, which is what we would call post-stroke epilepsy, really. So if you kind of end up seeing people in clinic that had seizures at onset but none since and have been started on an anti-epileptic drug, there's always the option to discuss about weaning off.
Okay, great. And then kind of maybe moving into more long-term management, secondary prevention. Should we talk about blood pressure targets and treatments? And actually, I've got a question because we've talked about bringing someone's blood pressure down acutely to allow thrombolysis. But what about patients who are on a whole lot of antihypertensive before they come into hospital? Do you continue, and they've not had thrombolysis? Do you continue those medications while they're in hospital? Because obviously, unless you're going for thrombolysis, we wouldn't acutely manage someone's blood pressure in the
No.
immediate post.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, generally, I think it probably depends on what their blood pressure actually is. And, this is not specific to stroke medicine, but you could have somebody that arrives on four different antihypertensives with a blood pressure of 95 over 60. They've been on them for 10 or 15 years, and clearly we need to do some medication reviews to cut some of the polypharmacy out. So I would generally prescribe their normal medications unless they had a specifically low blood pressure, for example, and let's say they were a they had a systolic blood pressure of 90, 100, 110. I might consider scaling back some of their antihypertensives, partly because if they are hypotensive and hypoperfusing their brain, their stroke symptoms are going to be worse anyway. So I certainly would consider that. But if people are on antihypertensives normally and they're admitted with an acute stroke, I would still continue them generally.
I'd have a caveat here. So we had a patient who, was meant to be on four antihypertensives, and we prescribed them all. Transpired they just didn't take any of them. So within a day or two, had a very low blood pressure and a nice AKI. And actually, the reason why they'd had potentially had the stroke is uncontrolled hypertension because they just weren't taking their antihypertensives. So yeah, check the patient actually takes them, I guess, before you represcribe them all.
That's a very valid point. Yes.
And
Which
so,
we should all do every time.
indeed.
But
And so, patients who aren't on any antihypertensives have had an ischemic stroke, they've not been thrombolyzed. What kind of blood pressures would you be allowing in that immediate kind of post-stroke time?
I'd probably say certainly within the first 24 hours, I wouldn't really be lowering it at all unless it's persistently above something like 240 systolic, or they've got headache, confusion, evidence of renal impairment, or signs suggestive that they've got a quite nasty hypertension, really. So generally, I wouldn't. And the guidance is that we shouldn't be lowering blood pressures in people that have got acute ischemic stroke if we're not considering reperfusion therapy. We still don't entirely know the exact mechanism as to why people become very hypertensive after stroke or after ischemic stroke in particular, whether it's just an autoregulatory response to try and improve cerebral blood flow for the brain to save itself, or it's a reaction to ischemia and cell death, and that's what drives it. It's not quite clear. But I wouldn't be lowering blood pressure acutely in people that we're not going to intervene with. After about 24 hours, I'd probably then start thinking about getting somebody on some antihypertensives if their blood pressure is persistently high, because you're then starting to move into that secondary prevention territory, of, we have encountered this event, and therefore it's now about looking at risk factors to reduce the chances of it happening again.
Chris, in terms of targets and things, I guess with it being a Geriatrics for Juniors podcast, one of the most challenging patient groups I guess we have is it's almost easy to target a blood pressure for someone who's in their mid-60s, who's not really got much in the way of other comorbidities. But when you have a frailer patient or, a patient with multiple long-term conditions who has a stroke, do you have a particular blood pressure approach for those kinds of people?
Yeah, I think it probably depends on how well they can tolerate certain medications and what the risks are. So we would generally advise, so the long-term target really is 130 over 80. That is the standard for secondary prevention for blood pressure management and stroke. In patients that are older and frailer, it's about weighing up the risks and the benefits of aggressively pursuing blood pressure lowering for the chances of them developing postural hypotension, falls, hip fractures, AKI, issues with medication concordance because they're on so many different tablets. So I tend to be pragmatic whilst also trying to be as reasonably
Not
aggressive as
nihilistic, yeah.
possible. Yeah. Let's say, for example, a classic conundrum is blood pressure is persistently 160 over 90, but also has postural hypotension. And what do you do about that? And the more medications you give, It's just, exacerbate the postural drop and make their gait and balance worse and increase the falls risk. And in some cases, we might consider referring these sorts of people for things like graduated elastic compression stockings or an abdominal binder to facilitate blood pressure management, particularly in people that have had hemorrhage where the sole cause of the bleed might have been hypertension in the first place. So you have to treat it. So we often work with orthotics to try and help manage that in those sorts of people because they're the real challenging ones.
And if people have kind of carotid stenosis bilaterally, do you have a higher target for their blood pressures? You wouldn't try and control that as well.
So typically in people that certainly have got bilateral carotid disease, you can ease off the blood pressure targets by a good 10 or 15 millimeters of mercury, systolic and diastolic. And equally, if somebody's got quite a significant carotid stenosis on one side that might not be suitable for carotid intervention because they're frail, for example, and again have a relaxed blood pressure target there, because you're then at risk of people developing hemodynamic TIAs and low flow stroke and all those sorts of things if you really aggressively start chasing the blood pressure. So yes, for those sorts of people, we would add on 10 to 15 millimeters of mercury as an acceptable.
I suppose that leads us maybe quite nicely into looking for carotid disease in the patients that have had a stroke. So, what stroke subtypes would you be looking for carotid disease for?
So it has to localize to the anterior circulation. Anyone with, well, attacks that makes a good recovery, PACS that makes a good recovery, lacuna stroke syndrome that makes a good recovery, they're the people that would be candidates for carotid intervention, because obviously cerebellum, brainstem supplied by your vertebrals and your basilar. So even if they've got carotid stenosis, it's not symptomatic, so it's not relevant. So the stenosis has to be symptomatic and it has to be on the correct side. There have been some trials looking at intervening for people with asymptomatic carotid disease, but that's mainly been done in America, and we only really operate on people who've had what we call a symptomatic carotid. So it's the same side as the brain that's been affected by the stroke. People have to have made a good functional recovery so that they would therefore be a candidate to be able to have major surgical intervention, because it's not a low risk procedure. It carries a 2 to 3% risk of stroke in itself, requires general anesthesia, usually often a stay on HDU overnight, etc. So, people have to be good enough to be considered for that kind of intervention. And let's say, for example, you're 85 and you have carers 3 times a day and you're mobile with a frame and spend most of your time indoors. You're not going to get the benefit as opposed to the risk that you're going to be subjected to from having that kind of intervention with that level of frailty, and other medical problems. So people have to be good enough to have major surgery and have to have made a good enough recovery from their stroke, and the vessel abnormality has to correspond to the area of the brain that's been affected is the kind of simple way to decide who's eligible.
Is there a time frame that you'd kind of aiming for?
Yeah, so the original trials suggested that 2 weeks, within the first 2 weeks, was when you s aimed to get the most benefit. So we want
Quite
to do it
soon
as soon as
after, isn't it?
possible. And different places, depending on where you work, will probably have different guidelines, because everybody interprets the data in certain ways. And certainly within our region, there are slight differences in the way that things are managed. I would probably argue that if somebody's got a high grade stenosis, up to 3 months is probably reasonable, but that's just based on my own personal interpretation of the carotid trial data, and other people might agree or disagree, but that's just my personal practice. But generally, it's the first 2 weeks is when you're going to get the biggest benefit, really.
So if you've got someone who's had a tachycardia or a PACS and it's taken a little while to recover from it, if it goes beyond that 3 month, you don't refer. Does it say it's got to that point?
No, generally, because if you're thinking that the stroke has been caused by kind of atheromatous plaque rupture, by that point the plaque will have stabilized and healed to some degree, and therefore that risk of early recurrent stroke will have passed by that point. Whereas if you've got a kind of unstable serrated plaque early on, then the risk of recurrent rupture and embolization is very high at that point, which is why they want to intervene sooner.
And then we've not yet talked about antiplatelets. So immediately after a stroke, you're looking at kind of high dose aspirin. And then how long would you tend to continue that?
So that's probably changed really in the past couple of years. So depending on the size of the stroke, that'll depend what kind of antiplatelet strategy we use initially. So if someone's had a very minor stroke with an NIH score of kind of 0 to 3, we'd probably give them a stat dose of aspirin, but then start them on dual antiplatelet therapy for 3 weeks.
Yeah, and then continue the clopidogrel after. Yeah.
So we do dual antiplatelets for 3 weeks and then switch to clopidogrel monotherapy after that time. If people are allergic to clopidogrel, we can use ticagrelor as well as aspirin.
Okay.
So there are other options now compared to it just used to be some aspirin, and that would be it. So TIA, high risk TIA and minor stroke, we would give dual antiplatelets. If they've had a stroke with an NIH of over 3, we would tend to give them high dose aspirin for a fortnight and then switch them to monotherapy.
Yeah.
Chris, I've worked in places where they would give 2 weeks of high dose aspirin even if someone was discharged, but in other places where when they get discharged, they just go to the clopidogrel after 7 or 8 days. Is that just, there's not really, is there any evidence or particular, or is it just kind of more
No,
individual ideas?
I think that's probably just quite straight-laced interpretation of the guidelines, which used to be obviously 300 milligrams of aspirin for 14 days and then give 75 milligrams of a single antiplatelet. But my experience was that I saw a few people in clinic 2 or 3 months later who were still on 300 milligrams of aspirin and 75 milligrams of clopidogrel. And I just think realistically, that's a higher risk than somebody being on 75 milligrams of clopidogrel versus 300 milligrams of aspirin. So I don't personally.
So, Chris, that's all about the antiplatelets. If you have a patient that you find is an AF while they're on the ward, at what point would you start anticoagulation? And does it depend what type of stroke they've had and how large it is?
That's exactly right. So it used to be that we would wait 14 days after 14 days of 300 milligrams of aspirin and then switch them to an anticoagulant. But people are probably missing a window of anticoagulation during which they're at quite a high risk of recurrent stroke, where we thought the bleeding risk was probably more considerable than it actually was. So things are moving a little bit differently now. There is currently a research trial called Optimus, which is looking at the optimum timing to initiate anticoagulation after stroke, so that we can have a bit of real world data about when it is safe to give people anticoagulation after they've had an ischemic stroke in people with AF. Generally, my practice tends to go on stroke size, as you said. And there was a European Society of Cardiology guideline that I thought was quite useful, which was it was the 1-3-6-12 day rule. So obviously, if they've had a TIA, which has meant that they've had complete resolution of their neurological symptoms, then you can anticoagulate them on day one. If they've had a very mild stroke, you could anticoagulate them on day three. If they've had a moderate stroke, day six, and then a major stroke, something like attacks, a disabling stroke, then day 12
Okay.
to day 14. So I tend to go by that realistically. Quite often, what becomes easier is you tend to sort of split it into a week or 2 weeks. So if they've had a sort of mild to moderate stroke, I'd think about a week, and then if they've had a severe stroke, it would be 2 weeks. So it's relatively tailored and individualized to the patient that you're seeing, and if they've had a minor stroke but the blood pressure's high, then I might wait a couple of days to get the blood pressure a bit better controlled before we put them on an anticoagulant to therefore reduce the bleeding risk. So everything's got its own caveats, I suppose. But 1-3-6-12 is a rough guidance, and then if you want to simplify it further, then a week or 2 weeks realistically.
That's helpful.
So we're definitely doing it sooner than we used to.
Yeah. And actually, just while on the topic of AF, if you've got a patient and you've monitored them in the HAZU, you've not had any evidence of AF, which patients would you be considering doing a bit more prolonged ECG monitoring on discharge or kind of later down the line to kind of look for AF?
Yeah, I think people who are young in the first instance. So the definition of young is now changing as we all get older. So kind of, it used to be sort of 40s and then 50, and then now we're sort of saying that we would call a young stroke 55 and under, really.
Yeah, you talk about yourself there, Chris, or you mean population as a whole?
I am certainly getting older, that's right.
Not quite reached 55 yet.
Yeah,
Time is not on our side for those of us that work in the NHS, is it? But yeah, so we're kind of calling young stroke older than we used to. So I think young people with no obvious vascular risk factors definitely need screening for AF, as well as other kind of investigations for young stroke that we would tend to do. People of any age that have a stroke with no identifiable risk factors, you have to start thinking about whether they've got AF as the underlying cause. And people that have a resting abnormal ECG, so if they have lots of atrial ectopics or the PR interval's not normal or they have a bundle branch morphology, all makes me think that they might have a more vulnerable electrical circuit to predisposing to bursts of paroxysmal AF. So they're the sort of people from a kind of basic standpoint. The other people I would probably say are people with cortical infarcts, so not your standard lacuna syndromes, which are the ones that are affected by disease in the very small arteries that are quite deep within the brain, that are the ones that tend to be furred up first with dyslipidemia or diabetes or smoking or hypertension. So if they've had cortical infarcts, that's also another thing to think about. And if they've had infarcts on both sides and they've got infarcts in different vascular territories, that again would fit with them potentially having a more central embolic source. So they're also the kind of people that you would start screening for paroxysmal AF.
And what kind of length are you kind of doing ECG monitoring for those types of patients?
That's a good question. And I can't give you any specific statistics in terms of pickup rate between different durations of Holter monitoring post-stroke. It's low generally. The amount of AF that we pick up post-stroke on Holter monitoring is low. And a lot of it is deemed by capacity, really. For me personally, if I'm going to request an outpatient tape, I'll do a 7-day tape. Just anecdotally, if I've got the option to record for a week rather than 48 hours, I may as well try and capture a bit more time to see if we can pick it up. In people, in those younger people that I was talking about earlier that might have stroke of unknown cause, and despite lots of other investigations that we could probably have a quick chat about, nothing comes from it, then I'd be talking about implanting a loop recorder to monitor for AF in the background that obviously goes in for 3 years.
And then maybe just while we're on the subject, looking at those young stroke patients, what do you do differently in terms of investigations for them?
So younger patients with few vascular risk factors, you have to think about what the underlying etiology of the stroke is, and obviously it depends whether it's ischemic or hemorrhagic. So we'll talk about ischemic stroke in the first instance, but generally for those people, we would do if a CT doesn't confirm the diagnosis and we're a bit suspicious about what the cause of it is, then we would do an MRI to confirm that they have actually got a lesion. And then they would have either a CT angiogram or an MR angiogram from the aortic arch all the way up to the vertex to prove that they've not dissected as the first cause of their stroke, because dissection is the more common cause of ischemic stroke in younger people. And it also means that you then don't have to go looking for other things because you know what the answer is very early on. So we would tend to manage those people with antiplatelets for at least a year and then think about whether they need re-imaging or not to see if the dissection's healed. So that's the first thing that we would do. They then need a prolonged period of cardiac monitoring, which in the first instance is a week's tape to make sure that they've not got paroxysmal AF. And we would then tend to do a bubble echo. So that's obviously a standard transthoracic echo, but with the injection of saline bubbles to look for a patent foramen ovale. So that's obviously an abnormal connection between the atria that would allow a small peripheral clot to translocate from the right circulation to the left circulation and cause stroke. And we know that about 20 to 25% of the background population have a PFO. And most people with one don't really have a problem associated with it. But if you have a stroke and you're young and there's no other risk factors, then there's evidence to suggest that it will significantly reduce the risk of recurrent stroke if it's closed. So that would be the other thing that we would go looking for. And then in terms of blood tests, obviously we would do the standard stroke bloods, which is obviously kind of full blood count, renal screen, liver, lipids. ESR looking for inflammation, and we would tend to do a vascular tic screen if there was a suspicion about vasculitis, and we screen for HIV and syphilis, and we would also do an antiphospholipid screen as well to look for antiphospholipid antibodies. The reason being, obviously, if they have a stroke and they've got antiphospholipid antibodies, then we'd probably look to anticoagulate them rather than give them antiplatelet drugs long term. And we tend to manage those people in conjunction with haematology.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. And then I suppose the last thing that we've not touched on yet is kind of lipid control and what kind of targets are we looking at for those people who've had a stroke?
So generally, we want people with stroke to have a non-HDL cholesterol less than 2.5. That's the long-term target lipid profile. And when we start people on statins, we would generally give them a high-intensity statin, so either atorvastatin 40 or 80. For most people, it's 80 if they'll tolerate it. And we generally repeat the lipid profile at 3 months, which is usually done in primary care, so we don't do that necessarily. And you're looking for a kind of 40% reduction in in non-HDL over that first 3 month period that you start them on the statin.
Okay.
But the long-term target is less than 2.5. And if that doesn't work, then obviously then you can add in something extra like ezetimibe. But again, as Johnny said earlier, it comes down to compliance and are people taking the tablet or not, or do they take it once every 4 or 5 days, or did they read an article in the paper about muscle aches and they've just left it in the side cabinet? So again, it's a sort of discussion about why people's cholesterol isn't coming down as it should do if they are theoretically taking the statin.
Check they're taking the first drug before adding in the second drug is the basic message there. Well, I think we've done quite a comprehensive cover of kind of secondary prevention and also the complications that you might see after stroke. So thank you very much, everyone.
No problem. Pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank
And
you.
as always, our CoTecast are available on iTunes and on our website, which is www.aeme.org.uk.